This is an ABC podcast.
This is Baby Talk Podcast with Penny Johnston.
In Australia, cardiovascular disease takes the lives of 22 women every day. Could it be related to what happened to your heart during your pregnancies? 30,000 pregnant women in Australia are going to develop high blood pressure this year. 10,000 of those women can also get preeclampsia, a condition that is only now thought to significantly increase a woman's risk of heart disease later in life. Now, here's the big statistic. Women who suffered from preeclampsia are 2 to 4 times more likely to develop high blood pressure in later life, twice as likely to suffer a stroke or heart attack. And 2 out of 3 of those women who have had preeclampsia will die from cardiovascular disease. Professor Anne-Marie Hennessy is the Vascular Immunology Group Leader at the Heart Research Institute and the Dean and Foundation Chair of Medicine at Western Sydney University. She's been working on preeclampsia research for 19 years. And Professor Hennessy, I think we're just starting to acknowledge that women's hearts are quite different to men.
No, exactly right. And part of our team in a broad spectrum across Australia have been looking at what pregnancy does to a heart. And when you think about the fact that when you're pregnant, you're carrying an extra litre of blood volume. So normally you have 5 litres, 5 Coke bottles worth, and then you go up to 6 litres when you're pregnant. And all of that is partly to deliver a substantial amount of blood flow and nutrients to the baby through the placenta, of course. But that has to go through the pump. And the heart that's had to live for 9 months with a variable and increasing volume and volume of work to cover the needs of the baby is going to be structurally changed forever, I would think.
Yes, yeah. And I can't believe this hasn't been a subject of research earlier, though.
There's a lot of research around. But look, the trouble is, in a way, that things have been studied in pregnancy as an event that we think is completely done. You know, we've studied what happens. You deliver the baby, you move to the next phase, which is sleeplessness. What did Prince William say the other day? Welcome to the Sleep Deprivation Society, you know, and the kind of things we think about our health are more to do with the change in our family life and structure and the needs and providing for the family needs around us. But actually, if you think about the events of the pregnancy itself, it makes some sense that we should be targeting and thinking about the ongoing impact of those events. I mean, women, when they're pregnant, feel palpitations much more commonly. They feel their hearts coming out of their chest, and they often describe that feeling. And with some of my female cardiology colleagues over the years, we've looked carefully at this. And as long as the heart's what we call structurally normal, doesn't have leaky valves or holes in it or anything, that fast heart rate, although it's much more conscious, is very well tolerated by pregnant women, clearly essential for the way that the mother and baby respond to the pregnancy. But if you've been racing along like a marathon for 9 months and then you go back and you have more than one baby, you know, it kind of all starts to add up, don't you think?
Yeah, I would imagine. Mm. And I just remember having that incredible pressure with a big boofy baby up on the diaphragm. It's obviously got to reduce a bit of space for your heart to operate in.
Oh, I think that's right. I mean, we have to expand our lung volume as well. So we push aside more guts than we do hearts and lungs, thank goodness.
Sure, but yeah. This is influencing me to want to go and get a heart check.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. The work that my team have done over the last decade has been looking at individual women, but also across big swathes of the population. There are some surveys that have been done on older Australians called the 45 and Up study, and we interrogated the women in those studies about their events in pregnancy. And we've had a series of pretty serious publications now that have identified that telling us that you had high blood pressure in your pregnancy or other events such as gestational diabetes are more likely to have landed you in some hot water about your heart or your blood pressure more in your 40s than in your 50s compared to women who didn't have those complications in pregnancy. And also, the more babies you have, the more burden there is on some parts of the body in terms of long-term outcome. But one of the upsides of that study has been to show that the cumulative breastfeeding time that women undertake with their babies protects against blood pressure. So it's really good news to find that this is not just an inevitability of having babies. You know, women live longer than men. It can't be all bad. But
yeah, good point. I'm glad you raised that. But you've got this amazing statistic that 2 out of 3 women who experience preeclampsia will die from cardiovascular disease. Now, I had not heard that before.
Look, women most commonly, one of the commonest causes of death in women as we get older into our 80s, given that that's the longevity of Australian women, is going to be from those what we call chronic non-communicable diseases. It's going to be cancer, and we've got fantastic screening strategies and some very early and effective treatment for women's cancers, though not by all means all of them, but those strategies have started to have an impact. And cardiovascular disease is the other big group in women of that age. And we know that having your body respond to your pregnancy, and it may be a toxic placenta, but to respond to those events by an elevation in blood pressure and then perhaps the other features of preeclampsia does in fact bring the blood pressure on a bit earlier. So I think our study showed that you're 47 when you get high blood pressure rather than 56, and that decade of extra long blood pressure, if it can be well treated, may impact on reducing what you just described as an horrific increase in risk that's associated with the way that you're going to see off your life in your 80s.
Because often preeclampsia babies are delivered a bit earlier, which would make breastfeeding harder. That possibly one of the reasons?
Look, again, you raise a fantastic point. And we tend to talk about those early severe cases because they're so dramatic. I live and breathe this condition with the women that I care for. And there's no doubt that bringing on a baby at 27 weeks, which is 3 months early because of preeclampsia, is a bus crash. That baby's going to be in intensive care for months. Those women are often very sick, which is the reason why you've needed to deliver them early. And they do focus our mind on the issues that you just described. The mother's not ready to make copious amounts of milk at that stage, although with encouragement and the right kind of support, the amount of milk we need can be provided, and women's milk strategies can increase with time, but it creates a whole set of complexities. What we need to understand about preeclampsia, however, is that it's a disease that becomes more common the later you are in your pregnancy. So around the world, the commonest preeclampsia is actually at term and even immediately after the delivery. Let's get our heads around that for a moment. So what happens is that the placenta makes toxic proteins that in some women just takes off like an absolute storm and makes them sick and you deliver them. But the placentas also make good things. They make things that keep your blood pressure low. So when you've got sometimes there's a balance where the good stuff is ramped up as well as the bad stuff, and it kind of holds the wild horse in check, the minute you deliver the placenta, not only do you lose the bad hormones, but you lose the good ones, and suddenly the damage of the bad hormones can hang around for up to 3 months, in fact. So we see women, I've seen 2 or 3 in the last week alone, that have looked on paper and felt very well, you know, right up until the moment that they deliver. And a couple of days, a day or two after the delivery, are suddenly headachy with extremely high blood pressure, and where all of the treatment needs to kick in. A little easier to do with the baby out, because you can use treatments that, of course, are unsafe primarily for the baby directly, but obviously, you know, still focusing on getting that blood pressure under control and supporting the heart health of the mum in the moment. And those events can even occur in the middle of labour itself. So you come into labour and everything's okay, maybe a bit puffy, but a bit nauseated, but labour's started, and suddenly we start recording the blood pressure in labour and we're getting readings of 170 on 110, which for these mums is just, whoa, you know, enormous blood pressures, and where the treatment and the team need to kick in to get things under control to get the baby out. And again, some of our work has looked at whether, you know, if you've managed and controlled the blood pressure and sort of treated the preeclampsia, if you like, for several weeks or months, does that change this outcome? You know, does getting the blood pressure under some level of control with pills mean that the outcome's different? And disappointingly, in a way, the answer's no. If you have preeclampsia, you have preeclampsia. And the fact that your body has responded in the moment, whether it's delivery or before or after, indicates that not just that you're the kind of woman who was going to get blood pressure when you're later, but we know that on top of that tendency that's built into you, the preeclampsia has done a little bit to move it along. So even when we control for the extent of the blood pressure control and the number of pregnancies, it's the event of preeclampsia itself that matters. And we think the thing that tracks mostly is how high the blood pressure goes. So the women, I think the highest blood pressure I've seen is 290 on 190. That's amazing, isn't
Blimey,
it?
Blimey, that is. Do we need to take a moment to describe what preeclampsia is?
Yeah, look, we know it's been around since ancient times. There are ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics of a woman with preeclampsia. So we know for 6,000 years of human existence, we've got records to show that it's around, and there isn't a ethnic group or race or country or province on the planet that doesn't get preeclampsia. Thin, malnourished African women get it, and overweight Scandinavian women, the rates are somewhere between 3 and 10%. Recently reviewed some papers from the South Pacific that are publishing rates of about 7% or so, completely consistent with, you know, hundreds of years of knowledge about preeclampsia. So we know that it's common. We know that it becomes more likely the further into the pregnancy that you get, and we know that you have to have a placenta to get it. So in some circumstances where you grow just a placenta and no baby, preeclampsia is almost an inevitable consequence that comes from a condition called hydatidiform mole. So you don't need the baby to get the preeclampsia, you just need the placenta. Isn't that weird?
That is so weird.
Placentas look different. The placenta from a normal pregnancy is about the size, I hope people are not having their lunch, but it's about the size of a dinner plate. And the placenta from someone with preeclampsia is more like the size of a bread plate, and they're grainier. If you feel the top of them, they feel grainy, and that's from calcium deposits where there's little tiny bits of dead placenta, and they're pouring out these extra hormones to try and correct their own problem, which is blood flow, and that all falls apart as the baby as obviously has more needs in the latter part of the pregnancy, which we think is why it sort of shows up in that last month.
One of the things I had heard was that your body sort of becomes allergic to the placenta, and
it's a really
immune response.
Yeah, an interesting theory. So we thought back to this notion that if you change partners, your rate goes up. So if you have a baby with that partner, your rate of preeclampsia, let's say, is about 5%. If you have the second baby with the same partner 2 to 10 years later, if you wait too long, it sort of disappears. And if you go too quick, your body's just not prepared. But let's say about 2 years later, with the same partner, your preeclampsia risk is a third of that. So it drops down to about 1%. If you change partners, so you remarry, repartner, and the second baby is with a new partner, you go back to the 5% risk. So that made us wonder what has memory. And so, of course, your brain has memory, but your uterus doesn't, we don't think, although maybe the uterus is never the same after it's had a baby in it. But the other part of our body that has memory is the immune system, and that's why we get vaccinated. So when you've had your vaccination for flu last week, I had mine, that teaches my body to remember what flu looks like. And when the people that I see in clinic this week are all coughing and spluttering, my body says, aha, I've got memory for that. I recognize it. My immune system will kill that off before I get my dose of the flu. So we understand and work with immunological memory every day. The placenta is planting itself into the lining of the uterus, which has those bloody components that we see when we menstruate. That's fine. That has glands that are rich in food to feed the early part of a baby growing. But it's rich with immune cells because it's like your mouth. You know, it's a raw surface that's in contact with parts of the outside world, and it has a very strong defense mechanism against things that could be introduced that could infect us. And the baby growing is foreign tissue. It's half dad, half mum. So normally, by rights, your immune system should say, foreign tissue, attack. But the nature of the immune system there in the uterus is a very old-fashioned part of our innate immunity. It doesn't need to be primed in the same way as we were talking about before with vaccinations. It's a very primordial kind of immune system. And the placenta has a neat little protein that switches that off. So this gentle balance between the placenta being a kind of leech and saying, ignore us, we don't want to be attacked, and the mother's innate immune system to do that is the other part of our biology that has memory. And so if you then get it less likely once you have a second baby with the first partner, there must be something about pump priming your immune system to say, I'm familiar with this, and there's less likely to have immune attack the second time. So that has been a hypothesis or a concept that's directed a lot of research in the last 15 or 20 years, much of which has been done by our team in looking at what are the modalities of that immune response, both coming from the placenta and the mum, to make all of that keep under control. So there's an imbalance in the immune system. There's something to do with the way the mum's vascular response, which is where our research group gets its name. And look, we are called the Vascular Immunology Group because we're interested in the interplay between the blood pressure response and the immune response, particularly in a mother that kind of unmasks this cardiovascular condition. And ultimately, the placenta just pours out these toxins and we're better able to measure those. That's now a clinical test I can do to tell me whether there's a high risk that this is looking like preeclampsia or not. And that's been available since November last year.
Wow.
And a lot of that work promoted by research groups in Australia.
That's a fantastic test to have.
Yep.
What's going to make the difference? Picking it up early. Is there anything that you can do?
At the moment, you give a much better idea of how much treatment you need. I had someone recently who needed to stay at work, and given what we were seeing, to be conservative and be careful about it in the past, I might have said, well, let's stop working and rest at home and we'll see you 3 times a week. But the preeclampsia test came back quite low, with very low risk. So we had a long conversation about the things we needed to watch out for and let's try and keep it work. And she actually was able to continue her job for 3 more weeks with close monitoring that wouldn't have been possible without the test in place. So where there's uncertainty about the diagnosis, very helpful. If the woman's got really high blood pressure and it's really obvious she's got preeclampsia, then she's in hospital and that's completely different. But where there's uncertainty about the diagnosis, I think it'll be very useful. And ultimately, the more we understand the mechanisms and what's going on and how this placenta gets into this mess from the early stages of pregnancy, the much better chance we'll have of putting things in that enhanced placental growth and get things boosted along, so we can then say it's a disease of the past. And I think that's within, you know, line of sight in the next 10 or 15 years.
And that does show a really great improvement, because preeclampsia used to be a death sentence.
Yep.
For both the mother and the baby.
I mean, the maternal mortality around the world has halved in the last 10 years. It's gone from 60,000 women to 30,000 women. Now, one woman is more than we want to see. And I was recently discussing with a colleague in part of the world where she had 10 women die from preeclampsia in the last 9 months, and the average age of those women in her community were 15 years of age. I can't tell you how that saddens me. Our work to make sure that we can make pregnancy a joyous event for every mother on the planet is what drives our work.
So anyone who has experienced preeclampsia, would you recommend that they collect whatever documentation they've got from their pregnancy and delivery and maybe make an appointment to have their heart and blood pressure checked out?
Yeah, absolutely, I would. I mean, I've been in the game now for 20-odd years, and we, you know, used to say really 20 years ago that it was all over. We're now saying, look, a bit like if your sugars are a bit unstable during pregnancy, it's enough to say that you're someone who should watch those things carefully and that you should undertake the right kind of evaluation in good time, 12 months, 2 years later, recheck your blood pressure. It's funny, as a clinical doctor, you know, I used to say to women, oh, you know, get your blood pressure checked when you get your babies vaccinated or when you go for your pap smear. And then I think when I go for those things myself, what a terrible time to check somebody's blood pressure.
Exactly. Blood pressure, it's always going to be higher when you're getting a pap smear.
Oh, and your baby screaming with an injection. Yeah. So I think the answer is to try and look at your heart health as being a very proactive strategy and not being able to use those excuses, you know, that there's a lot else going on. Women particularly, and men to some extent, have this condition that we call learned self-neglect. you know, that in the moment, it's everyone else in the family is more important than my own health. And by paying attention and doing all those wonderful things that the baby needs, I'll come back to my blood pressure in due course. And we're saying, as a part of the Stand By Her campaign and on the back of World Preeclampsia Day, look, think about yourself, and that your long-term health is actually going to benefit your family. And with the support of your family, make that time to do a blood pressure, a cholesterol check. If you had a sugar problem, pre-gestational diabetes or gestational diabetes, which is often, again, considered to be almost a purely pregnancy-related problem, to go and have your sugars checked and have a chat with your GP about what's the best options for your heart health. And obviously putting some preventive strategies in place with watching your weight and trying to get some exercise, aerobic exercise, as part of the mix, isn't it?
Can you prevent preeclampsia?
There's a big study published in the English literature about 2 years ago on the back of about 20 years' worth of work to see whether giving low-dose aspirin in the beginning of a pregnancy at the time when the placenta is being formed gives you a bigger, stronger placenta that would then prevent you getting preeclampsia. So there are places around the world that are seeing a reduction in the rates of preeclampsia. And in the English study, they went from a percentage of 4.6% women with preeclampsia randomised to treatment versus a sugar pill. The sugar pill women had 4.6% rate, but the treatment with aspirin, that group got only 1.9% of them got preeclampsia. Now, my problem with that study is that it was treatment given to a high-risk group, and I wouldn't think high-risk group is defined by 4.6%. In my practice, and if you look at genuinely high-risk women, women with kidney problems or with previous blood pressure, we're seeing rates of about 30% in that group. And of course, then reducing that, if we can, with a small dose of aspirin is highly desirable. What we'd love to see in the next decade is whether this strategy of preventing what looks like preeclampsia is actually achieving the cardiovascular benefits in 10 or 20 years' time. Of course, it will take a lifetime to sort that out, won't it?
I thought there was also a study with the Austin and South Africa that they were using a stomach medication.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So there's some looking at the antacid medications that were used. Look, they're very early days with those studies. Some of the ways that those drugs work can also affect the way blood vessels work and react. And there's also a big study in the UK looking at cholesterol-lowering medication. Look, I've expressed some concern about those because we just don't have the volume of pregnant women exposed to those medications yet to be really confident that the babies are fine. We think they are, based on the preliminary data, but we need to be very cautious in pregnancy studies that we're not doing things that run any kind of theoretical risk of causing problems from the baby's growth and development perspective, do we?
So if you had a patient who maybe that they had preeclampsia with the first pregnancy, how would you be setting them up for a good second pregnancy?
Well, just like you described, making sure that we have all the facts and figures at our fingertips so that we know how much preeclampsia there was, what duration, how high the blood pressure was, if we can find that out, and what other parts of the body were impacted, including, of course, the heart part of all of that, so that we've got a clear picture and can advise about what will happen the next time around. We can get some early pregnancy data looking at the ultrasound of the baby, and there are some features in the way the ultrasound's conducted that would give us a risk profile. We can do a blood test fairly early, and with that information, there's some algorithms or some mathematical guesswork around that says that you have a risk of 1 in 1,000, 1 in 300, 1 in 170, and based on those figures, have a discussion with your team, midwife and your obstetrician and perhaps obstetric physician or GP about the role of then instigating some preventive strategy. What's fascinating is that 75% of preeclampsia that we see in clinical practice is the first pregnancy. So it's all very well to say once you've had a pregnancy and you've had it, that's kind of the easier group because the mum's been tested, for want of a better word, in terms of how she may respond to a pregnancy. Most preeclampsia, if it happens very late in the pregnancy, isn't repeated. So they're the low recurrence rate in those women, particularly if they stick by the same bloke. Stand by your man, we say. But if you have very early severe preeclampsia, that's fine. But what do we do about the vast majority of the disease, which is your first pregnancy and you're just How do we put a prediction strategy in place? And the problem with some of the older aspirin trials is that they used women in their first pregnancy and the benefits weren't as strong. Mind you, they used lower doses than we use now. They used 75 milligrams and we're now suggesting that you need between 100 and 150 milligrams. Look, a standard aspirin tablet is 300 milligrams. It's just half of a usual aspirin. But we've been very cautious about managing the dose just because it is a pregnancy treatment.
Now, we want to make it very clear that there's nothing that you're doing to give yourself preeclampsia. So let's please take that guilt pill away.
But absolutely. Yeah.
What is it that you possibly can do? What do you know is going to improve your chances of having a less difficult preeclampsia?
Yeah, sure. Look, I think an early appropriate assessment for whether you sit in, whether you know it or not, a high-risk or a low-risk group. And there are certainly some women that sit in a high-risk group unbeknownst to them. So we certainly developing some systems at the moment where when you find you're pregnant, you can actually give yourself a quick score that looks like your high risk or low risk. And the high risk women don't need to do anything other than to get access to the best advice. And at the moment, that might include aspirin as part of it. There are some studies that show that countries that have low access to dairy products have higher rates. And in those communities, calcium supplements can help a little bit. There was a big study that was done in the US about 10 or 15 years ago looking at vitamin C and vitamin E that was very unenthusiastic results in terms of prevention. I think I've looked after about 14,000 women with preeclampsia. I've done my calculations the other day. And the advice in that setting is to listen to your body a bit, and some of the things we don't like are coffee and stimulants, and they push your blood pressure up. So I encourage women to eat well, and I think, you know, soft drinks are just dead calories to me. You'd be much better off to have a fresh orange, you know, with some soda water or some water or a piece of fruit and fresh water as an option. That there's just sweetness and no vitamin benefits in soft drinks and things, to be careful about a healthy and balanced diet. But as I said, you know, those things adding up together give you a better cardiovascular profile and a better plan. The issue about exercise in pregnancy is a pretty interesting one. You know, there's no doubt that keeping fit and healthy are very good for your overall cardiovascular health. But your body's telling you to lie down and rest like mad, particularly in the early parts of pregnancy. And again, we don't promote high levels of aerobic exercise, but we do promote a sensible approach to watching your exercise responses and how you feel. And particularly when preeclampsia has become obvious, women feel very unwell or can feel very unwell if they exercise, and we generally can in those circumstances encourage them to rest a bit more.
Being part of a obstetric practice or a clinic, making sure you get your appointments, get your blood pressure managed.
Yep. And the antenatal care is designed around preeclampsia. Everything else got grafted on. In the 1920s, they worked out that if we knew what your blood pressure was like and what was going on, and that there wasn't any sign of kidney disease by testing your urine early in the pregnancy, we could apportion a risk then, and then very little happens. So once we've worked out whether you're in the low risk or high risk group, then we see you monthly. When you get to 28 weeks, we start to see mums fortnightly, because we bit more preparation for where the baby's sitting and whether the head's down and thinking about the planning for delivery and breast care and those things. And then from 36 weeks, which is in the last month, we generally see women weekly at that time. And that's because it becomes more likely that things like your blood pressure will be problematic and those checkups need to happen. As we get better at putting the preventive strategies in place, maybe we want to see a few more visits early in pregnancy. That's called turning the triangle upside down, and we're busy looking at whether that's a better strategy. But they're the best ways to engage. I mean, I do see women who come to see me at the clinic who are high risk, but they're 28 weeks or 30 weeks of gestation, and it's too late to put some of our strategies in place then. And look, you don't need to come to a research preeclampsia specialist. These are strategies that obstetricians and midwives and good obstetric care can build around a planned pregnancy, for sure.
And if you have had an incidence of preeclampsia, this is a hint to you, a strong hint to go and discuss your heart health with your GP.
Absolutely. Blood pressure test particularly, because that's the thing that we can control. And there's a whole lot of lifestyle things that people can do to bring their blood pressure down. Even for women who are very overweight, even losing 5 kilograms, I've seen, you know, weight drop from 140 kilograms to 135 kilograms and we can take a pill away. You know, one less treatment that's needed. So there's lots of data about not just the weight reduction, but the turning your attention to vegetables in your diet and a more balanced approach to diet and reducing a whole lot of elements. This is not here to be, I'm no dietitian, but paying attention to some of those dietary things impacts both on weight and very quickly on blood pressure. So it's nice to think there are things that you can actually contribute to your own health and well-being, isn't there? The Stand By Her campaign that the Heart Research Institute is instigating around World Preeclampsia Day this year is very much saying that pregnancy is a journey for the whole family, not just the mum. The mum will find her way through all of that, but what a wonderful chance for dad and the parents-in-law. And we often, you know, in my own family, my sister and my sister-in-law and I happen to have a photo of all of us pregnant at the same time. And the reassurance from other family members about how to make all of that work in the best positive way and share information are a critical part of having a baby. And women do it very well. We're saying that we want to wrap the family around that as well. And what a wonderful opportunity for the future parents and the grandparents and parents-in-law to participate in using that moment to think about their own health and well-being.
Thank you so much for listening to the amazing Professor Hennessy, and I hope we haven't scared the living daylights out of you. If you did experience high blood pressure or preeclampsia during your pregnancy, the advice is pretty clear. It will not hurt you to go back to your GP and have your blood pressure and heart health checked. Now, this, we acknowledge, is a podcast or story that you might really need to share with someone you know who has experienced preeclampsia. This, I'm sure you'd agree, is information these people need to know and an example of how medical science is catching up with what we've perceived as not necessarily a health risk. If you'd like to listen to this interview again or to share it with somebody, you can find us online on the Baby Talk website by searching Baby Talk, one word. There's a share button on the website where you can share this podcast to your Facebook page, email it or tweet it. And Baby Talk is on Facebook and on iTunes, and you can share the podcast through that medium as well. I'm Penny Johnston, and I'll see you next time on Baby Talk.
ABC Baby Talk is a weekly podcast on ABC Digital Radio, wherever you get your podcasts and on the ABC Listen app. Like us on Facebook to find out as soon as a new episode is ready. Just search for ABC Baby Talk.